Good morning and welcome to This Green Earth. Joining us now is author, naturalist, and filmmaker Priyanka Kumar. Priyanka has recently penned a book that delves into the science of the apple, its fascinating history, and what this iconic fruit can teach us about reconnecting with lost biodiversity and forgotten landscapes. The book is titled The Light Between Apple Trees, Rediscovering the Wild Through a Beloved American Fruit. Welcome, Priyanka, to This Green Earth.
Thank you, Claire. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm thrilled to have you join us today and that we have the opportunity to learn more about you and this book and how it came to be. So let's start with sharing more about your background as a naturalist and how you became interested in this topic and began to pen this beautiful book. So tell us what first drew you to your line of work.
Sure. I like to say that I've been a lifelong naturalist. I grew up in the foothills of the Himalayas, and from a very early age, I was running up and down mountains, and I actually was fortunate for part of that time to grow up in Himachal Pradesh in the heart of the apple growing region in the area. So as a very young child, I was smitten by apples. And as I write about in the book, and I won't spoil it for the readers, but I was about four when my dad took me to this amazing apple orchard that visit was a seed that I think later in life it sprouted into a more mature love for apple trees. And every autumn, that visit would keep coming back to me. And finally, I decided that I needed to unpack why those apple trees were so important and what they were trying to say. And I think, in a sense, that quest led me to researching apple trees and their significance in the natural world more deeply. And I eventually began to write this book.
Yeah, it's really interesting in the book that you go through this memory, which becomes your North Star for a journey to write this. And I think we can all relate to these memories in our childhood that connect us deeper to something or deeper to the natural world. And you really go on quite a quest to bring yourself back to that joy or that moment that you felt when you were just a four-year-old child. And we'll get into this parallel that you had with your own child in that way. But first, I want to get into this term that you use called microwilds, because it is really interesting. Can you describe what you mean by microwilds, how this plays into this book, and what these areas mean?
Sure. I would say that this is one of the biggest discoveries I made while writing this book. And, the microwild, I came up with that term to refer to scraps of nature, fragments of nature, which are still large enough to harbor notable biodiversity. And so one of the things that I began to notice soon after we moved away from the Himalayas, I spent about the first 10 years of my life in the foothills. And after that, we moved away to, more urban areas. And then here in America, I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico, that not all of us have the kind of access to true wilderness in the way that I had as a child. And yet it's really critical that we have a strong connection to the natural world so that we care when the rhythms of the natural world are changing. So how do we do this? And incidentally, there's been a study recently that said they estimated that over the last 200 years, our connection to the natural world has gone down by something like 60%. Mm. And part of that has happened because we are no longer transferring our nature traditions to our kids. And so I was thinking a lot about some of these things, about access to the wild and how we can still connect with the wild on an everyday basis. And that's when I stumbled upon what I now call the microwild, these scraps and fragments of nature where, to my surprise, I found feral apple trees and I found tracks that a bear had made to get to these apples. And, there were bull snakes around. And I felt like, well, this is not the wild, but this is a good enough scrap that I can still experience a taste of the wild, and I can give that taste to my own kids. So I wanted to define this space because these microwilds are accessible to us, and because they are still these beautiful spaces, it also means that they are under tremendous development pressures. So I felt like it was important that we have a name for these spaces and that we begin to value them in a more formal way so that we can love them, yes, but also figure out ways to conserve them.
Right. Earlier in the show, I was just speaking with author Sophie Pavel about symbiotic relationships. And you just mentioned that bear. And in your book, you provide an example of mutualism between a bear and an apple tree. So right. What does this relationship tell us about the survival of both the apple and the bear? And greater yet, how can that relationship help maintain balance for that ecosystem?
Right. That's such a great question. I mean, one thing that we learn about both the apple tree and the bear are that those organisms are incredibly resilient. And I researched bears deeply for this book, and it was fascinating. So bears are called megafaunal mammals. These are mammals who are, heavier than 90 pounds, let's say. Mm-hmm. And so back, about 40 million years ago in the time of the Eocene, megafaunal animals began to develop a stronger mutualism with plants of the rose family, such as the apple. The apple comes from the rose family, as do many other fruits that we eat today. And so as that mutualism developed, what was so interesting to me is that the fruit itself began to evolve and become bigger to be more attractive to a megafaunal mammal such as the bear. So there's this kind of like a concert, this relationship over millions of years between bears and apple trees. And apples used to be this very tiny fruit that were, more attractive to birds, but they, oh, wow. The fruit became bigger and bigger and became more attractive to bears. And so bears, of course, eat apples. They love apples, but they also provide a service because they spread apple seed through their scat. And not just apples, but also other, for instance, choke cherries. That's a plant that's very difficult to grow from seed, but scientists have found that it grows rather easily from bear scat. So one of the amazing things I discovered while researching this book is that bears are planters, kind of like farmers. Mm-hmm. And not only are they in our microwilds even today, but they are actually planting a vegetative community in the microwild that is supporting them and also supporting other organisms such as birds that are depending on that microwild as well.
Yes, that interconnectedness is always so fascinating. And I want to get back to also us as humans and that interconnectedness and that parallel that we talked about, how you as a child have this memory that you keep unpacking about this wild orchard in the Himalayas. And you also talk in your book about how your four-year-old child brought you to one of these microwilds in your own community. And it seems like when we open ourselves up to these things, we're welcoming discovery into our lives. And this seems like that jumping point where this all started to really unfold for you.
Yeah, I mean, I really do think that children are one of our greatest teachers. Because children, of course, love to play. And play is what we as grown-ups have forgotten how to do. And I do think that one of the greatest challenges in our lives is to be able to, after we're educated and after we're so knowledgeable, is to be able to circle back to that sense of, wonder and that love for discovery and play that we had as children. So in a sense, I've allowed my own children to be my teachers. and lead me to these wonderful spaces. And yes, you're right. It was my four-year-old who led me to this microwild, which ended up becoming such an important inspirational point for the journey that I take in this book. And then, of course, we kept hiking and hiking in this microwild. And at some point, I think she regretted taking us there. And so we had to carry her back.
Yeah. Well, I love that visual of sharing this with your child and opening up that sense of wonder for her as well. And you share experiences of your journey throughout this book with the apple, and how it is a representative or more about connectedness and our history. And it has such a rich history, and one that I know we don't have enough time to unpack here. But can you give us some highlights? Because I think in America, we have this sense of connection to the apple, and mm-hmm. but it obviously traveled here, and there is a deep-rooted history. Can you share with us a brief explanation about how it came to be here in America?
Sure. This was just endlessly fascinating to me, all the connections. The apple is a portal that takes us into deep science, but also into American history, and I tried to explore it to the extent that it was possible to do so in the book. Of course, settlers came here with apple seeds from all over the place, not just from places such as Ireland and England, but also Spain, where they had learned how to grow apple trees from the Moors. So there's this rich international history of growing the fruit that settlers bring to America. And one of the things that really inspired me personally while I was taking a deep dive into American history is the relationship that one of the founding fathers, John Adams, had with the fruit. And at one point, he was an ambassador to England. And I think he and his wife, Abigail, of course, there's a beautiful love story there. You know, there were tensions back then between America and England. And at one point, Abigail says that she enjoys being in her garden more than, you know, navigating all the politics of the mm-hmm. British court. And they really meant it. Both John and Abigail were really into cider. And John had this habit. He wouldn't dream of starting a day without a gill of apple cider. And so it's not enough for them to make their own cider, but they want to grow their own fruit trees, their own apple trees. So they were really into this. And John Adams, you know, would experiment with getting seaweed into his compost pile to nourish his apple trees. And it was his dream to grow apples that one day his own grandchildren would be harvesting. He could visualize his own grandchildren harvesting apples that he had grown through, you know, the labor of his own hands. And so I found that to be very touching. And I felt like, well, here's a dream that we can all take something away from. And I felt that I did steal John Adams's dream there, and decided that I want to do the same thing. I want to grow apple trees that one day, not just, you know, my own kids, but just like a whole generation of younger people will enjoy and can be inspired by and get to know all these different varieties. Because of course, you know, there were at one point there were 16,000 name varieties of apples in the country. And we've lost a lot of that richness. Perhaps about a fifth of those are now accessible to us today.
So you describe truly wild or feral. I like calling an apple feral because it drums up such a picture in my mind's eye. And then they become domesticated. And like you said, as time marches on, we are experiencing a loss in apple diversity. Can you share with us what is meant by a feral apple? And are there still wild apples here in America?
So, of course, the true wild apple, the scientific name of that is Malassezuvercy, still grows to this day along the flanks of the Tian Shan Mountains in Kazakhstan. And, the temperate forests in Kazakhstan and Central Asia have existed for well over 2 million years. So the apple has been growing there, and they're also facing some of the same issues that I think all across the world we're facing, is just habitat loss. And so the spaces that they have for these beautiful wild apples are also sadly shrinking. But this is the birthplace of the apple. And so for a long time, we thought this was the ancestor of the domestic apple, which is Malus domestica, which is what we have here in America and what we eat today. And for a long time, scientists believed that Malassezuvercy, the wild Kazakh apple, was the ancestor of the apple that we eat today. But it seems like the apples had this incredible journey where it's a transnational fruit and it actually traveled. I kind of go through this roller coaster ride in the book, and it traveled through Europe where it actually hybridized with the European crab apple and then made its way to America. So today, what we have here in America is the domestic apple. And we also have four types of crab apples here, incidentally, that are native to America. What I refer to as feral apples are not true wild apples, but these are self-seeded apples that, were planted by bears and are at the edges of forests or fields and what have you. They're wild enough. There's, sometimes they're spitters because with apples, really, if you want a specific variety that you covet, you actually have to graft that variety onto healthy rootstock. So if you're just going to plant the seed, you may well get a spitter. But sometimes I'm out there in the wild and, there's this glorious apple tree, and lo and behold, you reach for the apple and it's quite juicy. And it could be that these feral apples just taste good because, you're out and you're exhausted from your hike, and it's just lovely to have this juicy fruit, and you're not too particular as, you might be in a more formal, in an orchard setting, and there you could enjoy, a real heirloom apple, something like the amazing Black Oxford that is, an important apple for people who live in Maine, for instance.
Sure. And what areas of America are you most likely to find these feral apples if you're looking for these micro wilds?
That's a great question. And, after the book came out, I heard from a lot of people on the East Coast who said that, we don't really think of New Mexico as a place where apples grow. But the apple grows under temperate conditions, and you can find feral apples anywhere from Vermont, where it's a lot wetter, all the way to a drier region like New Mexico. And part of the reason that we have these beautiful feral apples here today is that, of course, when the Spanish came here, they were planting apple seeds all along the way. And sometimes these were formally cared for, and sometimes they weren't. And the trees just grew. I mean, I found myself going to a village, a manzano, which is named after the apple tree, in New Mexico, where it seems that they have some of the oldest private orchards in the country. I mean, who would have thought of that? We always think of settlers, and it's true that in the 1600s, the settlers were already planting these trees, these beautiful trees, in places like Jamestown. But there's almost a parallel movement right here in the Southwest, including in places such as Tucson, where I went to the Mission Gardens and found that people there have been going to old homesteads and grafting some of the older varieties and bringing them back to these gardens and planting them as a showcase of our rich apple history. So I think these trees are really all across the country. I mean, it's kind of like a treasure hunt that, in a sense, I want to send my readers off on. It doesn't really matter what state you live in. I'm sure that there's some feral trees, there's some heirloom trees, that there's many discoveries to be made.
Well, we only have a few minutes left. I could talk to you forever. I love your writing. It's so poetic. It's so beautiful. And how you went about this research is so experiential. And we feel that as the reader. And I think that this connectedness that you bring to this and this understanding about our history and how we can connect ourselves through something like an apple and have a greater understanding of who we are as humans, about our history and about where we are today is really amazing how you brought that to life. So are you still feeling like you are on this journey? I would guess that you'd have a hard time not finding a micro wild now. I'll never look at an apple the same way again after reading your book. So do you feel like you are on a life's journey still with this connectedness?
That's a great question. Yeah, definitely. You just, you know, you fall in love with this fruit for life. That's for sure. And I think what gives me personally a great deal of joy is sharing these stories with the community and especially with the younger generation. So now that I'm growing my own apples, you know, I might have a wonderful variety. For instance, one of the varieties I'm growing is the Newtown Pippin, which is one of the oldest varieties in our country, dating all the way back to the 1750s. So when I was harvesting these apples last fall with my kiddo, it just felt very special to be able to tell her that this apple was being grown by the founding fathers, all the way going back to 1750. And, you know, this is not maybe perhaps one of the finer varieties, but what's wonderful about the Newtown Pippin is it's a great keeper. So back in the day before refrigeration, you know, people could ship this apple. And in fact, we did ship it. It was Benjamin Franklin's wonderful idea to export it to Britain, where it became a hit. Oh. And Queen Victoria herself became a devotee of the Newtown Pippin. So while we were harvesting this, right, you know, out in my own backyard, I was also relating this history to my own daughter and experiencing her eyes widen when, you know, because normally when she hears about Benjamin Franklin or Queen Victoria, they're such distant figures, but we could talk about them as, you know, people who also really love the Newtown Pippin, the very apple that we would be slicing for breakfast the next morning. So I find that it brings all of this history and lore closer. And so I keep transmitting these stories, not only to my own kids, but to kids in the wider community. And I think that essentially is what fuels me to keep on going on this juicy journey.
I love that, juicy journey. Well, the book is called The Light Between Apple Trees, Rediscovering the Wild Through a Beloved American Fruit. This is Priyanka Kumar. Priyanka, thank you so much for joining us today on This Green Earth. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Claire. It was my delight.